Hey, everybody, this is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, though as always, you may feel free to call me Mr. Lairness. All right, a little bit of an odd show this week, a long show, a lot of goodness, jam-packed full of goodness, but all of it pre-recorded. The first part is Dean Haglund and I remembering Stan Lee and talking about his cultural impact and some of the controversies surrounding him. Then the middle section of the show is an interview that I did with filmmaker Alana Rain in the woods here in Los Angeles a couple weeks back about her new feature film, her debut narrative feature film. Longtime listeners of this show will remember that Alana was our co-host during our 26-hour-long Mayan podcast-a-thon. So it's great to have her back on the show. And then I get back together with Dean, and we discuss a couple of movies during the final parts of the show. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. And I guess all that's left is to cue the new theme music.
And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness. Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, last week we did not have the time to remember I guess it's fair to call him iconic. Stan Lee.
Yes, American comic book writer, as he is known in the Wikipedias.
Well, if that's how the Wikipedias know him, then we're done. I think we could have fit that in last week.
Oh, gee. Yeah, we didn't. Oh, I guess I summed it up, didn't I?
Okay, so you know about comic book culture much more than
I do.
I'm not curious in you speaking ill of the dead.
No.
But prior to his death, if one was to ask you about your feelings towards Stan Lee, what would you have said? I'm curious.
Well, you know, he is a pioneer, of course. He created many of the characters that we know and love, you know, or co-created with Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, of course.
Right, yeah.
They were all working together. And, you know, how did you create back then? You just sit around going, hey, we need a guy. He's got a superpower. What's scary? Oh, the bat's scary. Hey, what about spiders? Spiders are scary, too. Oh, yeah, let's do that. You know, so, I mean, how much of that was whose idea is always up for a question. But that said, he, I thought, was excellent at marketing. He would be at those conventions. He would sign. He'd always end his Q&As with Excelsior, and the crowds would cheer. And, you know, so I have nothing but charming memories of seeing him on stage. I've never actually met him personally or talked to him, but I went to at least two of his, if not more, of his events. And, yeah, you know, I can't fault the guy.
Yeah, and much. I think there was a time when a lot of people did fault him, and I think what you describe, he both lived long enough, and he was just so, not just charming and funny, but so personable. I mean, he was just great with people. And so I think he outlived the furor surrounding his claim to creative ownership of these characters. Because it was a real controversy. And a lot of people, there was a time I remember when you would bring up Stan Lee and people would immediately badmouth him.
Because
we all kind of side with easily the person who feels they've been taken for granted and taken advantage of by the flashy front person, right? But then when he went out really into the world all the time, there was something so just, again, wonderfully engaging about that flashy front person that you went, no, he, you know, it's not that big of a deal. The controversy was not that big of a deal in comparison to all the joy they collectively gave people and then he individually gave people.
That's so true. And, you know, the Stan Lee Foundation, of course, he's created was a charitable thing. So he was doing good things, even if there, you know, as you said, the controversy. Controversy subsides after time.
Well, it is interesting. You're right. The foundation, which was all about promoting literacy.
Right.
And this is, I mean, this is not a joke. I'm not joking about this, but it will sound that way. Because in no small way, the culture he created did more to destroy literacy in this country.
Well, this is what Bill Maher was going on about, right?
Well, no, he was going off about something a little bit different, and we can talk about that. But I just mean in terms of comic books, the reading of comic books, and again, the reading set to visual images and what we know about dopamine levels and how empathic centers get activated. Even if you're reading a comic book on page, right?
Right.
You're reading it with different parts of your brain than you're reading a book. It is.
That's true.
And if you become addicted, as it is easy to do, to the reading of certain kind of material, it can inhibit you know, your reading levels. So something that had been a tool, certainly at one point, to induct young people into reading may have had at times a negative impact on people's willingness to read and ability to read. So that's what I mean. But yeah, let's talk about the Bill Maher thing. And then I want to get into this guy's kind of amazing biographical details. But Bill Maher, as I understand it, he didn't say it, right? Didn't he post about this? But he,
maybe. I don't know. Things on Facebook going, Bill Maher's a dick all of a sudden, and that's all I got.
Yeah, which he is. And so, but he said something along the lines of, you don't have a culture where a Donald Trump can become president without Stan Lee being a major figure. You want to know how we got here? It's in no small part because of comic book culture. And I think, as with everything that people immediately reject, boy, there must be some truth in that then.
Right. Yes. If everybody's reacting this. Yeah. Vehemently, then yes, indeed, there is maybe hitting a nerve.
Because, and we've talked about this vis-a-vis the X-Files, right? You're not, ignorant of the idea that, as Chris Carter is, that shows like the X-Files in some way are responsible for how we got here.
Ultimately,
human beings are responsible for human beings' behavior, not comic book writers, not science fiction filmmakers and television actors and writers. When nobody's responsible for what, but we all culturally have a role to play. We do all have a responsibility, and we all need to look at that. And So there is some truth to it, and the fact that it gets rejected so, like you said, vehemently, the reactivity of it means, oh, okay, this touches a nerve. Because
right.
if we don't recognize it as truthful, that's a big oh well. Right?
I mean, yeah, we don't go, we shrug our shoulders and carry on. Whereas if there is some truth to it, we go, what the hell are you talking about?
Right, right. It matches up to some voice inside ourselves, right?
Right, whether we recognize it or not.
You certainly are defensive about the idea of comic book culture if you're reacting to something Bill Maher says about Stan Lee. That's just the truth.
Yeah. Okay. So,
You know, my favorite line recently, by the way, speaking of Donald Trump was, you know, Donald Trump was on something and he was just ranting about the illegal goings on in the recount in Florida, recounts that went his way. And all they were about were not, they constantly are finding new votes. What? They're just recounting them.
But, not finding new. Yeah.
But I thought that gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum had such the perfect reply to him. It was a three-word reply. You sound nervous, was what he said. And that's now what I want to use all the time for people. When, you know, when they're reacting to what Bill Maher said about Stan Lee, it's like, wow, you sound nervous.
That's funny.
Because it might be true.
Right.
But you know, his influence is seen all over our culture. There's no question about it. Not just the comic world. But how about his collaborative approach to the creative process? How about the snappy dialogue he delighted in that just didn't affect comic books, but it affected television, and then it affected, you know, movies.
Yeah, for sure.
He came.
Yeah, the witty one-liners.
Sitcoms, video games.
Yeah,
all pop culture storytelling was affected by this guy.
Yes, action movies, for crying out loud. What kept you? Traffic. You know, how many action films have that joke in it?
It would be decades before he made his mark after starting in the comic books field, too. That's the important thing. This guy worked and worked hard for a lifetime. Let's not.
Right.
And if there's anybody, you know, you like to think that that is the trajectory. Somebody in his 90s who is drawing these big crowds and loving engaging with people as the reward for toiling anonymously, by the way, for decades.
Right.
His origin story has become canonical, but it's fascinating, and I find it inspiring. So I'd like to share a few of the points of it. But he's born in New York City in the tail end of 1922 as Stanley Martin Lieber.
Oh. Didn't know that.
You didn't know that. Okay. So you
no,
don't,
I did not know that.
You don't know why his name came about to be Stan Lee, do you?
No.
Hit
me.
He, as a teenager, dreamed of penning the great American novel.
Don't we all?
But because he needed a writing job to help out his impoverished family, he settled for any decent writing job he could get. And he got that in 1940. When a relative got him a job as an assistant at Timely Comics, the corporate precursor to Marvel. And at that time, Superman and Batman were on top of the world at the wildly successful DC Comics. Timely had just launched Captain America. And
cool.
Not long after Mr. Lieber arrived, Timely underwent a major organizational shakeup. He was one of the last people standing at the company and was named editor-in-chief, and he was all of 18 years old.
Holy crap.
Yes.
Think of that.
He would remain in this position for 3 decades. And for the first 20 years or so, churned out copy himself for a wide variety of unremarkable comics in as Westerns, crime stories, romance, teen comics, and
teen romance.
Lots of comedy titles. And
right.
he was utterly ashamed of the work he was doing.
Was he?
He was so embarrassed to admit that he wrote comic books that he changed his name.
To Stan Lee.
Because he hated comic books.
The irony.
I didn't want to use my real name on my work, he told the Radio Times in 2016. I was saving it for the great American novel, which I never wrote.
Or did he?
But
makes you think.
So who better to write comics than someone who hated them?
Well, you know, then you could throw it away easier.
Well, I mean, no,
you
but, know, but so also,
throwaway lines.
But also only Nixon can go to China. And so, yes, well, you have to do something that makes it worth your while. You can't last decades doing it.
Right.
You have to find something you love, some opportunity to engage your love. And in so doing, you're animating the very thing, animating being a bad pun, I guess, unintentionally. But I mean animating in that classic sense of breathing life into it. You know, this form in a way that nobody else could have. And that doesn't mean go out and hire people who hate the thing that you do. No, it
right.
means hire somebody who needs the thing that you do and might be pushing against something that will force them to get inventive, right? Which is what he did.
Right.
Another interesting part of the story is that in the 1940s, adults began to notice what their children were reading. And a moral panic of the McCarthy era swept through the culture in the 40s and 50s. And all these crusaders for decency started turning their eyes to comic books, blaming them for juvenile delinquency.
Ah, much like Bill Maher.
And so a Senate subcommittee was formed to investigate. And,
uh-oh.
Yes, citizens started burning all comic books. And the popularity of superhero titles utterly disappeared. And the comic book industry imploded.
Wow. Didn't realize that. What year was that?
Well, that was in the 40s and 50s.
That's when the implosion happened?
So throughout the 50s, Timely had to be rebranded as Atlas Comics. And Lee's output then diversified into all those other genres. Anything but superheroes.
Right.
So it was 1961 when the publishing operation was once again renamed, and before long, the new Marvel Comics line began rejuvenating the superhero genre, starting with a new series Lee conceived with artist Jack Kirby that was an answer to DC's recently launched Justice League called the Fantastic Four.
Ah, right.
Which
That's
was
where you start.
A team of superheroes working together, like Justice League, but tweaked into something brand new, right? Because
right.
These characters were notable not only for their strengths, but also for their flaws.
Right. That made them interesting.
And I would say, and then I guess we'll just move on from Stan Lee, but I would say that that's why Marvel, and you've heard me say this before, not DC, became the basis for a cinematic universe that changed the industry and affected things so much, resonated so much culturally. Because yes.
You said, go ahead.
Well, because it embraces a theme that we explore a little bit in The Truth Is Out There and which was desperately needed, which is this idea that what wounds us is what heals us, that the source of our strength comes from our wounding, as opposed to DC characters who have their vulnerability, and what do they do with their vulnerability? They hide it, they protect against it. It is literally their kryptonite. Right?
Interesting.
Where
yeah.
these characters come from, their origin story is their vulnerability. But in Marvel, their vulnerability is the source of their strength.
Right.
Think about
fascinating.
Tony Stark. Literally, his bum heart is the source of his strength. And that's what we want to know. We don't want to know that we can overcome or ignore or hide or defend against our weaknesses. We want to know that our perceived weaknesses, our woundings, the things we have survived might become the source of what allows us to thrive. We don't want to be loved in spite of our woundings. We want to be loved because of them.
Uh-huh. That's right. That's a happy overview to take away.
Well, it's not happy.
That.
It's just, I think it's just actual. I mean, what do these things mirror for what
right.
culturally we need? And that is what resonates.
That's right. So don't forget that.
You made a movie called Perception.
Mm-hmm. I did, and you came to
I saw it.
The premiere in L.A.
Have you shown it since then?
Nope.
Okay. Do we know where the next screening of it's going to be?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
We, it will, if something happens, it's going to be in the spring. Mm-hmm. We're aiming for something in New York, my old hometown. But no, nothing concrete yet.
Okay. We're kind of getting into the time of year where they're like between now and the end of the year, there's darn little going on in the way of festivals and
right.
things like that. I mean, may gear up again following the new year.
Yeah. And we didn't even apply for some of the biggies in January, like Sundance. We didn't want to wait, and we didn't want to wait for rejection because we just didn't think it was quite we didn't think it was their it's not their type of film. I see what they program, and you know, I didn't, you know, everyone's like, oh, you have to apply, and I feel like there's this thing with film festivals that's very troubling in that it's a money grab for them.
Yes. Well, and especially for some of the big ones where it's almost, you know, if you really peel back behind the curtain, rarely does a film without distribution in place
right.
actually get in there. And then lo and behold, the distribution is announced while there.
Right.
While the press is assembled.
But the
one that you might have looked at,
mm-hmm.
and you know, my favorite political t-shirt right now is not the one that I'm wearing, though I hope you like the one that I'm wearing.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Frack patriarchy.
Yeah. And I don't mean that. Doesn't not referring to oil.
No, I.
Yeah, we're not fracking. It's the Battlestar Galactica
exactly.
fracking. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
My favorite political T-shirt right now is you know how like you'll see, you know, presidential, you know, like Trump Pence 2020, right? Will be like an advertising sign, right?
Okay,
and that
sure.
means they're already running for re-election,
right?
And then you'll see jokes of, you know, funny things like Kirk Picard, you know, 2020. That's the ticket I'm voting for.
Okay.
Anyway, my favorite one is just Hindsight 2020.
Oh, nice.
Which is so good.
That's
isn't
great.
It? And what I love about it is it's actually nonpartisan.
That's
really is nonpartisan.
Cool.
You can all get behind. What would we learn in hindsight?
Mm.
Why I thought of that was because this is all in hindsight. But Slam Dance would have been the one that I would have thought, because it really gears towards first time.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a first time narrative or if you're a first time documentary, even if you've done something in the other,
right.
then you qualify.
Right.
And I feel they are trying to embrace, you know,
they're little
female storytellers
yeah.
also. So that's the one where I would have thought.
You know, it's so interesting because there used to be the LA Film Festival, but as you know,
it just went under.
And it's funny because we actually got some good feedback from them saying, you know, this film is really good, but pass.
And that was actually right around the same time as when
right.
we were.
So, you know, our goal was we wanted to premiere in LA for numerous reasons. You know, we knew we could fill a house with friends and, you know, connections, industry people. And we knew the venues in LA are really good and, you know, really great sound and projection. And,
right.
you know, after spending so much time making everything
right,
perfect,
right, right.
we wanted to do that. And it's just funny how things turn because, you know, the LA Film Festival, they said, you know, we found that in order to get a more balanced program, we had to actually stop including female filmmakers. And I read that when they said that, and I was like, you know, that would just never be the case with men. You can have film festivals programmed with like 95% men, and they would never say, you know. So I was really proud to be a part of DTLA because they are truly inclusive. And it happened to be that 65% of the features and docs that they programmed were directed by women. And I was like, you know, good. And they're not making a huge deal about it. It's just becoming a fact. And they made an intentional choice. And they said, we're going to really make an effort to do this.
Right.
And I don't know. That to me is good. And, you know, and all of their films sold out. So when LA Film Festival closed because of lack of attendance, you know, DTLA is packing the house. So it's like, well, let's see who's doing what right. And I don't mean to badmouth it.
No. Festival, but this just... it actually, from a business standpoint, this is something that, it strikes me about film festivals, right? When they're fun, why are they fun? One of the big reasons is because you have a sense of community in it, whatever that community is.
Right.
And it can vary from place to place, and it does, and festival to festival. But the ones that I love, it's all, boy, you go there and you really feel like, oh, I'm immersed in a community here. And but what's the community of LA Film Festival? What has it ever been? And that's the, you know, it's wrong to say that film festivals can't take hold in LA. There's too many of them, and it is difficult.
Right.
It's difficult because of the geography. It's difficult because of, the commuter nature of our experience. It's difficult because it's an industry town. There's so many challenges, blah,
sure.
blah, 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 blah. But the ones that pull it off, they understand that they're building a community.
Yep, absolutely.
Outfest is a must. If you just like good parties and want to know where they are in LA, go to Outfest.
Right.
They understand the importance of building community.
Yeah.
And so part of that is programming.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you want to foster community? Well, here's an idea. Everybody's welcome. Everybody's made to feel welcome, and not just because of lip service, but, oh, look, I'm represented on screen, both in front of and behind the camera.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that, you know, I don't understand. I understand fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand fear of growing old, and I understand that for some people, the as their days become numbered, they start to project that fear out onto the world, thinking, oh, the country or the world's days are numbered because my days are numbered.
So boring and limiting.
But I've never understood this white man fear that, oh my God, if women are given their due, I'm going to be irrelevant.
Right.
Because, you know, I had a mom, and I had a grandma, and I had a sister, and I never doubted that I mattered to them.
Right. There's some women doing that, too. That's the problem. I mean, you know, it's not just men who are doing it. There's some women who don't want to seem like they're giving too much to other women.
Well, no, that's true. We've talked about this on the show a lot, and in the especially in show business, how difficult it's been where, sometimes women who do make it then don't open doors for others because they think, well, nobody helped me. I'm not going to help them. But there's also something about the patriarchy, which is it's been able to maintain itself so long because proximity to patriarchal power often feels like power.
Absolutely.
So why do, you know, you think that educated white women, for example, might seem to be voting in a way that is counter to what might be best for them?
Right.
Because they enjoy their status of being next to power.
Sure.
So it's a fascinating. I mean, that's why the patriarchy has to collapse because it's so ingrained
in so
many people and so unconscious.
Yeah,
and it's frustrating for anyone who ever wants to be free and wants to be valued for their own unique nature and quality. And that includes white men.
Sure.
I will never be valued
truly for who I am as a white man. I know that because I get to be a part of this group.
Right. Well, you know, it's, but I think...
And I'm not complaining about it because I am the one who's the beneficiary of this in some ways. But at the same time, I'm aware I would like to be treated this way because you think of me this way and not because you think of my class.
Absolutely.
This way.
Well, you know, but also tackling it and tackling the patriarchy and tackling the injustice in, you know, something as simple as, you know, oh, you gave that short film director man a, you know, $30 million first time feature, but, you know, you just told me that I have to make a feature first in order to get that feature. And I that literally happened to me every time I would meet with a producer outside of my inner circle. So, but with that knowledge, it's like, I think it's awesome. I personally stay away from playing the marginalized victim card.
Sure.
Because the patriarchal structure is still so there. And if they see that, if they see that you're just hanging out on in virtual groups with, quote, angry women, you know, railing about this, railing about that, which I find tedious and tiresome.
Of course. Of course.
You're going to stay there. You're going to stay there.
No, that's why I actually think it is people who look like me that need to be railing against it.
Right. Yeah.
Because only, I mean, it's my responsibility to try to get my group to start seeing things differently.
That's really
that's my responsibility.
Yeah.
But not only the fact that you know, you don't want to be an angry, you don't want to feel marginal, you know, and the unhealthy nature of those feelings. Also, as a storyteller, right, you can tell better stories, and you can realize that, okay, I feel marginalized, I feel unseen, I feel whatever it is, underappreciated, and I have the ability to realize, you know what, that's a human feeling, and everybody feels that. At times. So right now, when I'm feeling this, I'm connecting in a very significant way with all of humanity.
Yeah.
So how can I use this?
That's very cool.
How can I tell a story with this?
It's a good shift, for sure.
But it is... you know what I said? Dean and I, we went out of our way a few years ago on the show to start generating these lists of movies directed by women filmmakers that everybody should see, and we would talk about one a week on it, and then sometimes have the filmmakers on. And what I love is, and we kind of dropped off on that a bit, but what I love is now like I said, oh my God, Deborah Granick has a new movie out. I can't wait to go see it. Or Kelly Reichardt has a new movie out. I can't wait to go see it. And I can't, you know, and what was great about it was I suddenly realized this year that there are all these women filmmakers that I don't think of as women filmmakers.
Exactly, and that's the
They're
key.
My favorite
there you
filmmakers.
Go. Nice.
My list of favorite filmmakers.
And that's the shift that has to happen on a broader scale.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I really don't do social media. I do it so minimally and... but when I do, it's, you know, usually about my work, and I've had people say, well, you know, you could get so many more people interested if you type female filmmaker, or female director, or woman director, hashtag woman director. But I said, no, I'm going to type hashtag film director.
Yep.
I'm not going to do this. It needs to be normalized. It's just like how cool Star Trek is when there is a gay relationship, or Battlestar Galactica. I'm talking about the new Star Trek. You know, how it's just like, well, part of the thing. Oh yeah, Sulu's got a husband and a kid.
I know.
It's not commented on. It's never ever referenced. It is integrated into the normal.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I think I felt that way, speaking of Outfest, I felt that way with gay cinema for quite a while, that it was very important that there just be stories about what it means to be gay in society. But we got to the point where I wanted to see in those kinds of festivals, like Outfest, more of an embrace of stories where the characters happen to be gay, mm-hmm. but it wasn't about them being gay.
Right, right, right.
You know, just like I don't want to see most movies that are about people being heterosexual.
Right. Yeah,
they might be. They might have, you know.
Right.
Heterosexual relationships in the movie, but yeah. but maybe the movie
well,
isn't about
the,
that.
That's the indie cinema, you know, angsty 24-year-old man walking around trying to find himself by having meaningless sexual relationships film that seems to be everywhere.
which I refer to as my home movies. Anyway, but I love, you know, it's important, apropos of what you're saying about not being a female filmmaker, being a filmmaker. You know, the term itself, filmmaker, was invented by a woman.
Mm.
Ida Lupino.
Oh, okay.
Coined the term filmmaker.
I love that. I didn't know that.
It was her independent film company.
Nice. See, that's why I come on this podcast, so I can learn something.
See, but you're standing on the shoulder of a giant.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, this is why we come to the woods.
Yes.
So that we can remind ourselves to deepen our roots.
Love
into
it.
The... okay. But so back to you and your movie.
Yeah.
Again, the title Perception. But it is interesting because everything we're talking about is shifting perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking around your movie. Mm-hmm. But I did find that very... interesting that that was the title.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start there? Why was that the title? Why was Perception the title of your movie?
Well, the film revolves around three characters and psychic phenomena. It's about a small-time psychic who encounters a real estate developer who's coming to basically evict her, and he wants to reconnect with his dead wife after they start talking, and the story moves on from there. They get very intertwined for this. So with that premise, my co-writer and I approached this from two different perspectives of believing in the supernatural, the paranormal, the idea that there's far more to this reality than we can see. And we imagined our viewers who would come see this film come with already somewhat solidified points of view about psychic phenomena. People believe it? Or believe it's possible that some people have a gift. And then there are people who are like, it's a load of hooey. There is nothing like that. Very material-based. So we wanted to create a story that would challenge people's perceptions, challenge people's tightly held beliefs. Because when we have a tightly held belief about the world, it can truly shape our reality and our experience of the world, how we interact with people. If you grew up believing that one race is superior to another because your parents were racists, that's going to obviously affect how you move through the world, and that's a belief. Your neighbor could have a completely opposite belief, that we're actually all created equal and that it's just a matter of skin tone.
Right.
Different religion practicing. And that's going to affect how they move through the world.
Right.
So we wanted to use the template of a thriller, supernatural thriller, to allow us a lot of wiggle room with that. So, you know, we wanted the viewer to think, oh, did that really just happen? Or do I want it to happen?
I want it to happen?
Yeah. Or is our main character, is she actually helping him or is she ripping him off? You know, mm-hmm. let's discuss that.
That's interesting.
You know, so that's how we landed on that title.
When Dean and I made Spectres, the tagline, and I didn't write the film, but I did write the tagline. And it was the saying, right? Seeing is believing.
Yeah.
So our tagline was believing is seeing. And this is what I hear you saying. And I'm wondering, is it safe to say, not that this should be true, but that perception is reality?
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's definitely a spectrum where that might become untrue. I mean, if there are people who might be experiencing delusions, hallucinations.
But if they're acting on them, if they're being acted upon by them, then they are again. They're manifesting.
They are. They're believing it's true. However, they might say, okay, I see this pink spotted horse, and it's there. I believe that pink spotted horse is there. I am now going to get on that horse and ride away. There is no horse.
Right.
They can't ride away. So where does that, you know, it's this vagueness of where that really begins and
but that
ends.
Still begs the question, to them, though, are they riding away?
Right. They could just then walk away and believe they're truly because, on the horse.
Because where is the difference between I really believe that this woman loves me and that we're married, whereas in reality, what we would call outside objective reality, maybe the man who believes that is a stalker and unwanted in the woman's life.
Absolutely.
But in terms of what transpires within that perception, outward understanding of reality doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I think this also really ties back into what you were saying.
And by the way, I was not describing my personal life. That was not the example I was gravitating towards. That was Alana's movie.
Right, but there is an actual wedding in February.
There is a wedding in February, yes.
But I think this ties back into what we're saying about judgment, because, you know, in the beginning, with, like, people judging you for spending money on saving your cat, people judging me for running back into a burning house to save my dogs, this notion that, you know, I personally strive for clarity in my life with you know, my own personal habits. And part of that it means trying to see other people's point of view, not always believing I've got the answers and that I'm right.
Right.
That someone could introduce something like, oh, you know, that person there can levitate people, not to immediately dismiss them as like a quack or like, okay, let's explore this. I don't necessarily believe you, but I believe you believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that we could actually really use, that helps me make my art, to understand how people could see Nina as a scam artist and how some people could see her as actually a healer. And that helps me with that, helped me with that. But it also helps with how we interpret what's happening politically.
And both. I mean, this is where it gets really fascinating to me. Why not both?
Yeah.
The exit polls in the recent midterm about how, you know, people are so freaked out that 41% of people polled approve of the Mueller investigation. 49% think it's politically motivated. The problem that a lot of us had was with the phrasing of the questions. It can be both a fact-finding mission and politically motivated. It can be both.
Sure. No, it can be both.
And someone could be both not a con artist, but financially manipulating someone, and can be a healer.
Yeah.
You know, I was always drawn by the story of Uri Geller. Do you remember?
Sure.
Father of a dear friend of mine who is a film producer, but his father was a publisher, wrote a magazine, wrote a book, was a journalist, really interested in exploring the idea of psychic phenomenon back in the late 60s and 70s, and was aware that, of course, the Soviets were spending so much money into this.
Sure.
And
remote viewing chambers.
So one of the people that he got to know was Uri Geller, and of course he became involved with the people who founded Noetic Sciences. But he had a lot of fascinating experiences with Uri Geller, and they are truly unexplainable, some mm-hmm. of the phenomena that went on, the things that would happen around him.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, because Uri Geller was, you know, the amazing Randy exposed him as a fraud and other things, he paints a portrait of Uri Geller as someone around whom all his life inexplicable phenomenon took place.
Mm.
And at some point, he knew he could not, however, expect or order up these phenomenon on demand.
Right.
So he'd better learn how to fake it so that he could start making some money off of it.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there was a yes and quality to it. Things happened, and there's a lot of tricks going on.
I hear that. But, you know, I think...
That describes to me politicians.
Right.
Hopefully most of them are motivated by, I'd like to do right by my fellow man. And then you get into this mix, and it's like, well, I'll still try to do that, and
right.
I'm going to fake it
right.
because that's part of the job.
Yes, and I do think that... Fortunately, this latest round, there's a whole bunch of new people that do seem uncompromised.
Yeah.
Like, right. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a little cynical. But I mean, there's a reaction to what.
It's not cynical. It's human psychology.
It's
We all get challenged by compromise in ways that are unique to ourselves.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes it's a fun exercise. I messed with my own perception when there were a couple of despondent moments. I mean, more than a couple when, say, you know, the Supreme Court thing or trying to take away people's health care, you know, just like really abject, cruel, horrible things that were like the transgender ban. You know, certain things where people's lives are genuinely going to be affected.
Yeah.
That at one point I said, I'm going to pretend to be the other side. I'm going to pretend in my head, I'm going to go through this whole exercise that I believe what they're doing is best for the country.
Yeah.
That I believe this. And I was really trying hard. And I was like, it'd be such a relief to be on the winning team. It'd be such a relief. I could just like be like, yes, they're right. And then I thought, oh, well, they kind of raise things to a fever pitch. And there's so much, you know, hatred and white nationalism and bigotry and homophobia behind it. I couldn't go there. I just couldn't go
there. Because you assumed that they really do believe that it's best for the country. I mean, I've had a clear understanding on this since before Trump won, because I knew he was going to, and having traveled throughout the country where I've never found anything called a red state or a blue state. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really have not found much difference between people anywhere. I mean, there's good people, there's bad people.
It's a media concoction.
But there's a lot of pain. And how does pain manifest? And how does pain get harnessed? And how does anger get harnessed?
Right.
And there were a lot of people that, quite frankly, were at the point where they were ready to just say fuck you to America and to its institutions. And they're still saying it.
Right, but why are they so angry, though?
Because they felt left behind and unseen and unheard.
Right.
And they were for a long time. I mean, honestly, you know... Literally, when you're a presidential candidate of a major party and you decide you don't need to visit certain places, what are you saying?
Right. No, that
what is the message that you're sending,
that was
right?
A big mistake.
But it's a mistake that has been in its own way repeated. And, and so, you know, that's the... When Dean and I talked the morning after the election... I said right then, I mean, we all felt a little bit sucker punched only in, not in the surprise of what happened, but then just in the question of, is this what we are? Mm-hmm. And, but I said that the legacy, ironically, will be that Trump will be responsible for making America great again. At least, it had better be the legacy. If for no other reason, then we're all going to
decide it's up to us to do the heavy lifting and do the work.
Right. And it's also shored up our institutions in a way that's encouraging. I mean,
hopefully.
Some degree.
I mean, the work's still happening. But it has to. What is the response to the nonstop assault on our institutions? To either let them die or to breathe life back into them. And you always have to breathe life back into institutions.
Yeah.
Right? Or they become calcified and they do crumble.
Well, maybe in some ways also this will teach us that the presidency doesn't have to be as important or revelatory and celebratory as it is. Like, maybe we could operate more like a parliament system, or maybe something where he's not, you know, it's not that important, because we have...
Well, just if we could go through days without hearing
right.
about it. I mean,
right.
we're talking about a movie and we can't keep away from them. You know, that's the thing. So what...
But it seeps in. The politics seep in yeah. even with the movie. I mean...
How can it not? Yeah. Everything's in a context, mm-hmm. as Dean says. But... at the same time, these questions of perception are those that, removed from the context in which they are made, still hold resonance.
Yeah.
Right? No matter the context,
right.
they hold resonance. What was the... I don't know. I don't want to say inspiration behind. I mean, not the inspiration to the story so much, but what was the genesis? What was the seminal moment of birth for this project?
Well, the idea was coming up with the story that we could self-produce with private equity from ourselves yeah. and our production company. And make on a budget, because I've got a sci-fi science fiction film. It's been in development. It's actually a trilogy for you know, a couple of years, but it's given me the opportunity to rewrite it. And while writing several scripts with Brian, you know, we have five under our belt, which I'm really excited about since I moved to LA. We would meet with various producers, people that called themselves producers. People that would tout connections, eyeballs. A few of them actually had genuine credits to their name that, you know, we would know about. But one person after another, one meeting after another, it was truly just became clear that it was a world of no, and we were navigating through it. And one of the ports of call in this world of no was, oh, we love the script, but you can't direct it.
Right.
For the reasons we talked about earlier. It was just too much money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that hurt on such a visceral level, because this was such a true personal passion project script.
Yeah.
With a whole world around it. Not just yeah. one film, but two others.
Right.
And a graphic novel and, you know, a video game. I mean, like a real world that we're building. Yeah. And we allowed ourselves to entertain it for just a bit, because this person was talking so much. And then it became clear that this person was a substance abuser.
Mm.
And in my own, you know, journey of awareness and clarity, I don't indulge in any intoxicants whatsoever. It's for my own happiness and clarity. So when I recognized
which it, I disapprove of, but that's my... I'm totally a scribe, of course, to the Dean Martin school, which is the problem with being sober is when you wake up in the morning, that's as good as you're going to feel all day.
I disagree completely. The natural highs are amazing. Amazing. Unlike anything else, Phil. Got to try it. 100
unlike,
days.
Unlike anything. Oh, I've more than that. I mean, I spent the first 14 years of my life sober. Okay.
Nice, nice. Oh my God. Not for children listening.
like most of Phil Lairness, not for children.
So, you know, I've recognized it like really fast, you know, with the excuses like, oh, I've got bad allergies. Oh, I have food poisoning. You know, all these things like coming to meetings, like literally sniffing. And it was at that point. So you, we obviously pulled out of that. Or there was nothing was ever signed, no money, nothing. It was all just talking and meeting and bullshit. And it was at that point I looked to Brian and I said, look, you know what? We could just go on like this for another 5 years in this town. Or we could just make something that also bends reality that, you know.
Yes.
And so we just, you know, heard some stories about, you know, people taking advantage of other people and you know, in the psychic business and, or, you know, whatever. And a good friend of ours is a psychic clairvoyant. He reads energy, J-Ro. And he does true healing. And he's truly helped people. I've had readings by him. And we're like, let's talk to him about what he thinks about how we can work with this, how we can work with this notion. So that was really the inspiration. It was like, let's make a film. It's not science fiction. There's not going to be any CGI. We're not going to wait 2 years to land a big star. Let's work with classically trained actors who've got great indie film and TV credits, and let's get this going. So that was the motivation, and say, okay, here's what we did for this, you know, and here's our product. So now we can show you, like, yeah, let's give them a couple $1 million to do the science fiction film.
Yeah. All right.
That was it. Just got to get it done on your own sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. At some point, just make something.
Yeah. Just make something. Exactly.
And, I mean, I'm at this point where, you know, it's, I mean, the more you work on, the more opportunities you have to work on things.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to happen that way, right? I mean, it creativity begets creativity. And it's, again, also just the idea a little bit of, again, a body in motion stays in motion.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and it helps, you know, shifting your perception and getting new ideas of how to go about and reapproach getting something else made. Yeah.
Right. Well, now it's a totally different ball game.
So what would you say, having done it, the film, what's the big takeaway that helps you, that you say to yourself, wow, I'm glad I didn't get to do the trilogy first?
Well, if I had given it away to not direct, that
I mean how has it worked? How has the order of this worked? And you go, okay, good. I'm so glad.
I see.
Even though I didn't know about perception,
sure,
that it existed
absolutely
in me beforehand.
Well, I know what's really important, what I need to fight for, in terms of a budget. Definitely, I know. I very much want to work with my the production designer and my DP again, because what they pulled off on the money and time we had is just incredible, and we worked really well together. So I feel like I'm assembling my team of not just extremely talented people, but people that have the right work ethic and temperament and vision, that able to help put my vision onto the screen just through communication. So that was valuable. I mean, who knows, if I had done Out of the Everywhere first, I could have used them or other people, and it would have been I might have said the same thing or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, just that. And also just the persistence and riding the waves better, riding the ups and downs, the peaks and valleys. not getting too exhilarated by the yeses and not being too despondent by the noes, but trying to just stay on some sort of equilibrium. Obviously getting a yes is better. Like when someone signs that contract and they're on board, boom, yeah, that feels great. But there's still so much to do, so you can't get carried away with that.
Yeah. It is interesting. People get so used to no's in this business that a lot of people won't take yes for an answer.
Huh. I kind of understand that in a way, but then you have
It's weird. They fight on yeses.
Like, well, that I don't
Or they'll know. Keep arguing. No, like, they'll keep arguing. You know, like, we need to do this. And you'll say, yeah, good, okay. And they'll say, because, and it's like,
and you're like
you already
got it.
Have the yes. You can take yes for an answer. I'll leave you with this, another sign of just a little bit of hope. Well, first, how can people learn more about Perception?
Oh, well, there's a website, perceptionamovie.com.
Okay.
They can also go to my website if they want, and you can hit the contact button, and that's my name, IlanaRain.net, I-L-A-N-A.
Dot net. We love the dot
net. I love
net.
My dot nets.
Oh, my God.
I-L-A-N-A-R-E-I-N.net.
We'll link to that.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the founder of Marvel Comics and the creator of so many great comic book characters. Stan Lee died, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw the one newspaper obituary headline, though, that had a photo next to him, and it said, Spike Lee dies.
Oh, no.
But I took that as so hopeful, because we were talking about, you know, it's great to not think of these filmmakers that I love as women filmmakers now.
Mm.
I just think of them as my favorite filmmakers.
Yeah.
Well, clearly, Spike Lee is no longer an African-American filmmaker.
Right.
He's no longer, I'm like, he can be mistaken for a 94-year-old white man.
I love it.
That, welcome to post-racial America.
That is.
We've made it. All right, Alana, nice. Thanks for meeting me in the woods.
I love it. Thank you, Phil.
Two movies that I want to talk about with you. One we talked about before, and it's a Netflix movie that debuts next month, and it's a big epic. And I gave it a fairly positive review, which is Bird Box, the post-apocalyptic action film starring Sandra Bullock, where she spends half the movie blindfolded. All the characters do. And it resonates. Talk about a movie that resonates culturally. It has a chance to resonate culturally. It was written long before the current political era, before the Trump era. A lot of people are going to want to interpret it for that. But it is interesting to watch a movie where, if people look at the world, they see the thing that they fear the most. And when that thing, and it's unique to each person, but when that thing manifests itself, it denies them of all hope so immediately that their only response is to kill themselves. That's
wow.
What the film is about. Boy, doesn't that resonate? That if you look out into the world, you lose all hope. And
right.
So the people who survive are the ones that don't look. And the only people who can survive looking are those who are considered insane to begin with. Those who
right.
believe that life is meaningless to begin with, they thrive because they're the ones that say, see, I told you, it's all meaningless.
Sounds interesting.
Sounds like conspiracy theorists.
Sounds like conspiracy theory, yeah.
So anyway, so it resonates. But the point that I wanted to say about this movie is it's written by Eric Hesserer, who wrote the fantastic Arrival for director Denis Villeneuve. But it's directed by and produced by and stars brilliant, talented, powerful women. And damn if the original script is the one that feels like it was made by talented, powerful women. And damn if the finished movie isn't the one that feels like it was made by a man. That original screenplay is so much better than the movie they made.
You're kidding.
And not only better, but better in a way that would have made me think that, yeah, women had at least an equal say in telling this story. But the finished movie is a very masculinized version of that original screenplay. And again, so different. Structurally, very much the same. Plot-wise, very much the same. but in terms of character and tone and exploration of themes, could not be more different. And that screenplay is terrific. And that screenplay is the one that's submitted for all the award bodies to read. So everyone's going to know how much better that is than the movie.
Oh, where can I read this screenplay? I want to read this now.
I will send that screenplay along to you. I actually used it and taught it in an acting intensive recently.
How fantastic.
Now,
okay.
Now, another movie I wanted to bring up to you, and I don't know if you've seen this, but a while back we did a show about our all-time favorite mystery films.
Right.
And what I love is apparently there are still great mystery films for me to discover.
Fantastic.
And it's stunning that I didn't know about this one. I didn't even know about it, and I don't know how, because I was 9 years old when it came out. I was alive.
Okay.
It stars big stars of the time, Oscar-nominated stars of the time, including an Oscar winner, Art Carney, and produced by Robert Altman. And damn if the opening part of this movie made me say, wait a minute, this is like an Altman film. And then all of a sudden, produced by Robert Altman comes up. It feels very much a spiritual companion to my beloved Long Goodbye. But it's 1977's The Late Show, written and directed by Robert Benton. So you don't know this movie?
No, I don't know this movie even a little bit.
How did we not know this movie? It stars Art Carney, Lily Tomlin, Bill Macy, Joanna Cassidy. It's a mystery with a few really good comedic moments. The story follows an aging detective trying to solve the case of his partner's murder, a classic setup, very Maltese Falcon, while dealing with a flamboyant new client played by Lily Tomlin. And it was hailed. I mean, it got nothing but 4-star reviews. It got an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay, for crying out loud, for Robert Benton.
What year?
1977. Pauline Kael.
Year of Star Wars. That's where it got buried.
But still, how do we not know about this, for crying out loud? Pauline, we both know movies, and we both were watching movies in that era, and I just don't understand. Pauline Kael.
Yeah, but we were getting inundated with the Star Wars. That was our marketing hammer on our head.
Yeah, but we still knew about Kramer versus Kramer. I mean, we still knew about Benton's other movies, so I don't understand. And Altman, oh, by the way, is my favorite filmmaker, so how did I'm baffled by this. But this is also a beautiful thing. It means there's still discoveries, right?
To be made.
But Pauline Kael wrote about The Late Show in 1977 that it never lets up. The editing is by Lou Lombardo, who has often worked with Robert Altman, and Peter Appleton. And I can't think of a thriller from the 40s that is as tight as this or has such sustained tension. The Late Show is fast and exciting, but it isn't a thriller. It's a one-of-a-kind movie, a love-hate poem to sleaziness.
Wow.
That's Pauline Kael, the dean of film critics at the time. Roger Ebert's 77 review in the Chicago Sun-Times, a 4-star review. Most of all, it's a movie that dares a lot, pulls off most of it, and entertains us completely without insulting our intelligence.
Wow.
One more review. A unique, one-of-a-kind film that lived up to its advertising tagline, the nicest, warmest, funniest, and most touching movie you'll ever see about blackmail, mystery, and murder.
Yeah, that's good.
100% positive on Rotten Tomatoes. Many award nominations, including a National Society of Film Critics Award for Best Actor for Art Carney. Lily Tomlin was nominated for both a BAFTA and a Golden Globe. It won awards at the Berlin International Film Festival, Writers Guild of America, and I don't know anything, I didn't know about this, and this movie, Dean, is so much fun, and even resonates, I think, more today than it did because of the ageist nature of Hollywood and Art Carney playing this over-the-hill, almost-retired private investigator.
Wow. I want to now see everything about this.
Yeah, it's
where can I?
It's
where did
so
you see
good.
It? Where did you watch it?
It played on TCM, and I thought, okay, mystery on TCM. I don't know this. I'll record this. And I sat down and watched it. And I mean, again, I didn't know the Altman connection. And the description of it was amazing because I thought it was a bad description on TCM. It said comedy about a private eye who helps a kooky woman find her lost cat. And not what the movie's about, by the way. The person who wrote that is like the Amazon reviewer I mentioned last week.
Right.
You know,
I hated it.
I hated it. In fact, I stopped watching 40 seconds into the movie. Take it from me. Not worth it.
Yep.
So
hilarious.
Anyway,
okay, I gotta find this thing.
But that's really fun, right? That there's still so many discoveries to make. And like we talk about context, because the context of the times are so much different than when most movies were made, there really is the opportunity to almost discover new works. The Other Side of the Wind was maybe only, again, a mirror that was being held up to what we can do. Yes, these filmmakers literally took a lost movie and put it back together for us to enjoy, the Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind. But we can do it individually ourselves. We can dust off movies that have been forgotten. And because of the context of the times, they might be more meaningful now than they were even at the time they came out.
Isn't that something? Wow. Cool. So I am, I'm going to do that. And I'm sure that... Yeah, you're going to be pleased, of course, in business news that your beloved A24 production distribution arm signed the deal with Apple that they are going to be providing content for Apple's new streaming service.
Am I going to be delighted or not? We need to really look into this and maybe really analyze it. I've been holding off on talking about it because... I'm not really sure I have a handle on my feelings about this.
Oh.
You know, I'm worried in some ways, but maybe we'll talk about that on next week's show because I think it is a direct response, obviously, to Netflix and what we talked about a few weeks back about how Netflix is dominating everything in film. And this is a response to it. I mean, I think actually, ironically, Netflix... I'll just say this. I feel like this is iTunes' move to catch up to the way that Netflix more embodied the principles that Steve Jobs laid out for Apple than iTunes has done.
Oh, interesting.
The idea of an enclosed system.
Right. Fascinating. So
let's talk about that and other things about how the business works or is being unworked on next week's installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Hooray! Let's do that.
All right. You can find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. You can download them, stream them, and subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review if you want to.
What could be?
You can follow us on what?
What could be more fun than writing a review, Dean?
I don't know.
You know what could be more fun? Reading them as I did recently.
Ah, don't do that. I never read them. Where are we on Instagram and Twitter? We're at the same place, Dean and Phil. Spell it the word and. Hashtag, we give a great hashtag. And if you want to email us, they can do that, can't they, Phil?
Well, we want to read their emails. We want to talk about what you want us to talk about. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. That's C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K. No C in it. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Finally, like us on Facebook.
Yes, please like us. We're at facebook.com/chillpack. Other spellings. Identical. Yeah.
What could be more fun than that? Okay.
I can't put a thing.
Until next week, I'm Phil Larenas.
I'm Dean Aglin. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
belated spoiler alert.